When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a fantastic guest, of course. This is Dr. Carl Truman. He is a professor of biblical and religious studies at Grove City College, and he is also the author of several books, including The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. So welcome to the show. How are you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me on, Zuby. It's great to be here.
It's a pleasure. I've been reading through that book that I just mentioned, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. More accurately, I've been listening to the audiobook. I'm a couple chapters in. I was hoping I'd be able to finish it before this podcast, but it's a really captivating book, and I'm really looking forward to getting through more of it. So before we get into some of the ideas of the book, please tell us a little bit about who you are and what you do for those who aren't familiar.
Sure. Well, you can tell from my accent that I'm not from stateside, though I now teach at Grove City College in Western Pennsylvania. I grew up in England, went to college at the University of Cambridge. I know you're an Oxford man. I was at the other place. I did my MA in Cambridge, my PhD at the University of Aberdeen, where I met my lovely wife of 32 years, Katrina. We both came to the States in 2001. And I taught at a seminary just outside Philadelphia for 16 years before spending a year at Princeton University on the James Madison program. And after my time at Princeton, I took the job at Grove City College, where I'm notionally in the Biblical and Religious Studies department, but I mainly teach on the humanities core. And I'm also a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center in Washington, D.C.
Awesome. Tell me a little bit more about your childhood and growing up in England.
Yeah, well, I from the age of about seven, my parents moved from Birmingham, where I was born. Birmingham is like the Detroit of England. It was where the car industry was based. But they moved to Gloucestershire, which is a very rural part of the country. So I grew up in the west of England. I know everybody says, you know, I had an idyllic childhood, but I really did have a pretty idyllic childhood. Very rural, beautiful countryside. Went to Marling School in Stroud, which was a very traditional boys' school, even though it was state-run. Mm-hmm. It was a very traditional boys' school. And from there, I went up to St. Catherine's College, Cambridge, where I studied classics. And for much of my life, I've been a church historian, but more recently moved into the realms of cultural criticism.
Awesome. And were you from a deeply Christian family?
Oh, not at all. My parents had no interest in Christianity whatsoever. I first heard the Christian gospel when my best friend at school took me to a Billy Graham rally, would you believe, at one of the local football or soccer stadiums, you would say over here.
You can say football to me.
Football, of course, as an Oxford guy.
Yeah.
and I became interested in Christianity through hearing Billy Graham, and probably it was sometime during my first year at university, reading books by Dr. James Packer that convicted me of the truth of the Christian faith. So no religious background at all. I came to Christianity not late in life, but a little later in life as an undergraduate at the university.
That's so interesting. And when you moved to the USA, had you spent much time in the States prior to that, or was it your first time going there?
No, it was actually my second time. My first time in the States, I was a visiting fellow professor at Calvin College, now Calvin University in Grand Rapids, in 1996. So my wife and I and our two boys, one of whom was only 3 months old at the time, moved to Michigan for 6 months and spent a very happy 6 months in Michigan, had a delightful time at the college. And it allowed me to know what living in America was like as more than just a tourist. So when the job offer came in around about 2000, from the seminary in Philly, I was able to think about it in a more informed fashion than I might otherwise have done.
That's cool. What were some of the big differences? As someone who travels a lot, I always like to compare and contrast different countries. And I find that the UK and US, I feel like they are more different than people appreciate. I think that because the same language is spoken, a lot of people think of the USA as sort of a big version of the UK, or the UK as a smaller version of the USA. But I think there are some real core fundamental differences that would perhaps be more obvious if there was a language barrier, as there is with England and other European countries.
Yeah, I think that's a very astute observation. I've often thought that the language tricks us into thinking that, you know, Britain is just an extension of the States, or the States is just a more modern version of Britain. Mm. I mean, there are a number of things I think that shape the two countries. On the negative front, I think race plays a particular dark role in American politics and public life. That it's not that there isn't racism in Britain, there is, but it's articulated differently. And I think certainly the Britain I grew up in, class was perhaps the bigger dynamic in terms of understanding politics and society than race. Mm-hmm. I think America has a much more individualistic and in some ways celebrity-oriented culture. Mm-hmm. It's always intrigued me that in America, in Britain we had David Beckham, but other than that, it's sports teams. Over here, everybody knows the big names, and the teams are almost adjunct to the name. And I think that speaks of something deep in American society, that you have a real confidence in the strong individual that we don't have in Britain. And that's not to say that Britain's right and America's wrong. It's just to comment on a difference there. And I think that also plays out in terms of attitude to the government. I think in America, it may be changing now, but certainly the America I came to in 2001, there was a deep suspicion of government and much more confidence in private corporations. In Britain, I think there's always been much more confidence in governments and much deeper suspicion of private corporations. So there are all kinds of interesting differences and nuances.
Yeah, you've touched on several things that I've thought of as well, because that celebrity culture, it even goes into the politics. Right. Yeah. So the way politicians, I mean, to put it simply, politicians in America have merchandise.
Yeah. I mean, that's very
right. You'll never see someone in the UK wearing a Boris Johnson t-shirt or flying a Boris Johnson flag. That would be very strange. But here it's considered totally normal to wear a Make America Great Again hat or a Biden Harris t-shirt or anything like that. It's a multi-billion dollar industry.
My son does have a pair of Boris Johnson Y fronts, but you'll never see those.
Yeah. And the point you touched on as well, you know, the first point here is bang on. I say that the USA is a more racialized society. I don't necessarily say the word racist, but the lens of race is used much more. Whereas in the UK, you said the sort of lens of class. And I think in the States, they're often conflated in a very strange way where people just completely overlap them. And given the different history, I understand to some degree where that comes from, but even the way people talk to each other, right? In the UK, it would be very bizarre for someone to call me Black British or African British, right? That would sound like the strangest thing. But in the States, it's totally normal to say, oh, white American, Black American, African American, Asian American. They always put this, not always, but they use the prefix. And I think that keeps it in people's consciousness. And I think actually it causes people to be more divided, at least mentally, than they really need be. I often tell my American friends, it would be great if you guys could just call everyone American and drop the prefixes.
Yeah, that's interesting. One of the things I've noticed in my 21 years here is that when we first arrived, the phrase un-American was used a lot on the news. And that seems to have disappeared from public discourse. And I wonder if that's because the notion of what it is to be an American is now so highly contested. You can only know what an un-American is if you first of all have an idea of what an American is. And I've also been struck at I used to joke at times, I'd be in a faculty meeting and somebody would make a joke about American sport and everybody, regardless of color, would laugh except for me, because I'm an immigrant and I don't get what's going on. It's just, you know, color is one way and race is one way of looking at things, but there are other ways of dividing up the world that are also significant. But as you say, I think that that term racialized, that's a very profound way of thinking about American culture. Yeah. Very distinctive.
Yeah. And, you know, I think a lot of it is a hangover from the history, I presume, because I guess, you know, of course, people were, you know, artificially put in these boxes and assigned these labels.
Yeah.
And even though, you know, a lot of the dark and horrible stuff in that history is over and done now and has been for decades, it's still very much in the public consciousness. And I think because as well, you know, I love the USA, everyone knows that, but because the truth is most Americans never leave the country. So there, it's a much more, US centric, I think it would be fair to say Americans are on average, not as worldly as people from the UK or Europe in general, just in terms of traveling outside and having knowledge of what's going on.
It's a huge country. I mean, my country is about the size of Kansas, I guess, something like that, whereas America is vast.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, you see, again, the history, clearly Britain was deeply involved in the slave trade, but it was colonial slaves.
Exactly.
People of color in Britain are not the direct descendants of people who are enslaved in Britain. Mm-hmm. They come as immigrants. So British racism tends to operate more along lines of immigration and less, I think, along lines of skin color, by and large.
Absolutely. So as I said, I've been listening to the audiobook of The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self. It's such a fascinating book. Can you tell people what it is about in summary, and perhaps even more importantly, why did you choose to write it?
Well, maybe I'll take the second half of that question first. I became fascinated with the question of why the sentence, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body," had become so plausible in our culture. We all have strong opinions on whether that's a true statement or not, but I wanted to get at a slightly deeper question. Say, well, why is it that it's come to grip the popular imagination? What has to have happened within our culture for that sentence to make sense to so many different people? So the project itself really started as an attempt to get at that. What has gone on within society, particularly in the West, that makes that a plausible statement? And that led me then in an interesting direction, because it became clear to me that one cannot say that that's become plausible simply because somebody's made an argument and society has been convinced by that argument that that sentence makes sense. Society's been convinced that sentence makes sense because a whole host of other things have taken place within our culture that have served to prepare the ground for the reception of that sentence. And if I could simplify the argument of the book, I might say what has happened is inner feelings and inner psychology have been granted an authority that has come to trump everything else. If I were to say, you know, Zuby, let's, you know, 100 years ago, you go to the doctor and you say, "I'm a woman trapped in a man's body," the doctor, not that you would ever say that,
I don't know if you're aware that I am the British women's deadlift record.
I was very impressed, actually. That is an awesome achievement, I have to say. but your doctor would have said to you, you know, that's a problem, but it's a problem of your mind. We need to bring your mind into line with your body. And the doctors, they're operating in a world where the physical body still has tremendous authority that will ultimately ace particular feelings that one might have about one's identity. Today, you go to the doctor, the doctor's likely to say to you, in fact, maybe legally obliged in some places to say to you, that's a problem. It's a problem of your body. We need to bring the body into align with the mind. When you compare those two scenarios, what has gone on in the broader frame is that external realities, we might say, have come to play a less and less authoritative role in who we think we are, to the point now where inner convictions, specifically on the matter of gender identity, have come to ace biological realities. So the book is an attempt to trace that out. And of course, that doesn't happen overnight. The book goes back to the mid-18th century. I could have gone back further, but somebody emailed me once and said, why don't you go back to the Garden of Eden and Adam and Eve? I said, because the book would be 100,000 pages long and nobody would read it at that point. You have to start somewhere. But I started in the 18th century where we have this move in Western Europe to start granting much greater significance to the individual's feelings than had typically been the case prior to that. And I trace the story from there right up to Bruce / Caitlyn Jenner in the present. Mm-hmm.
In the book, you talk about the age of that we're living in the age of psychological man. What does that mean?
In some ways, that's a term to sort of capture what I've been just been talking about. And psychological man is the person who thinks that their identity is constituted by their feelings, by their inner psyche, by their inner space. But it has more, it's got implications as well. For example, psychological man will therefore have a view of happiness where happiness is feeling good. Mm-hmm. And therefore, good and bad, good and evil start to get transformed. And that which is bad is that which stops me feeling good. That helps explain, for example, why speech has become so controversial. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure when you identified as a female weightlifter, you had some pretty interesting responses there. You know, it was a joke, but people have been saying this is hurtful, this is offensive.
Well, you know what was fun about it was that it was very much a checkmate maneuver, because the only options were to deny that I am a woman.
Yeah, which must have found very oppressive.
Yes, which would be transphobic by the true believer's own definition, or to accept that I am a woman and therefore I am the British women's deadlift record holder. So it was quite fun because even the people who sort of viscerally on a surface level wanted to be annoyed by it or wanted to criticize it, they didn't really have any leg to stand on. Because if they say, hey, that's a man, that's not really a woman, then... Ooh, I mean,
that's hurtful.
Yeah. What about Caitlyn? What about Caitlyn Jenner? I mean, if I were to say that, people would label me transphobic and say that I'm being a bigot and I'm not accepting this person. So they've kind of boxed themselves into this corner where you can, you know, and I think a mistake a lot of people who criticize this actually is they try to use pure, you know, logic and reason, not recognizing that the people who have reached these conclusions or who support these ideas haven't come there from a point of real logic and reason. So right. all I did was take it and say, okay, those are the rules. Okay, cool. So let's do this thing. And then I think that's a much better way to expose it. I mean, for example, the issue with women's sports, which has bizarrely been going on for, I mean, that was 3.5 years ago where I did that. And it amazes me that this conversation and so-called debate is still raging on. And I'm like, man, I think if that's what the rules are, perhaps the best way to end this is just to have a ton of male athletes in every single sport just do what I did. That'll simply put an end to it, because using facts and logic and reason, explaining the biological differences between male bodies and female bodies, it doesn't land with them because they're not talking about biological reality, as you've alluded to.
Yeah, and I think that goes to the heart of the issue, that this is intuitive. Mm-hmm. It's the way intuitions have been shaped. When you start to bring logic in, it's pretty easy to demonstrate that the intuitions are bogus.
Yes.
That the intuitions cannot explain reality as we actually experience it. And it's one of the reasons why I think on the trans front, I'm relatively optimistic that in the long run, this thing will collapse under its own weight. Mm-hmm. Sadly, I suspect an awful lot of people are going to suffer terribly in the interim. And that makes me want to bring it to an end quicker and sooner rather than later. But I do think you're pointing to a fundamental incoherence that ultimately we cannot organize reality along these abstractions, because it simply isn't workable.
No, it's not. And it's concerning because there are so many things that are gray areas and things that are actually not binary. I mean, most things are not, in fact, binary. This is one of the few things we have in our society, which is a very simple, it goes beyond humanity, because across the entire animal kingdom, we have male, we have female. Every single person on this earth who exists right now and who's ever existed was birthed from a woman. We know this. Yeah. We walk around every single day, and with pretty much 100% accuracy, 99.9% accuracy, you can accurately tell the sex of every single person who you see. Children can do it. Babies can do it. Even dogs can recognize people. So it's very odd just having this thing where it seems like, you know, 99% of people know the truth and know the reality, but there's a certain percentage who have been, you know, I think a very tiny, tiny percent who have been ideologically captured. But I think the vast majority, again, it's this tiptoeing around, it's this oversensitivity, hypersensitivity to people's feelings and people's truths, which is a term that's used now instead of there being the truth. It's his truth, her truth, my truth, your truth, and all that. And it's very strange because it's just something that's so fundamental. And I think that's why it's captured so much interest, because the percentage of people who actually identify as, you know, transsexual or transgender, it's a very, very tiny minority. I don't think most people probably know anyone who is actually identifies as such, yet this conversation is going on for years, and so many academics and people are really, really looking into it and thinking about it. And it's odd because on some level, it seems like one of these things that doesn't really matter, right? Sometimes some people are like, oh, you know, like why even talk about it? It doesn't matter. It's this very tiny percent. But I think the greatest concern with it, there's a lot of concerns with it, especially when it comes to things with children and what's actually being done, but it's this full wholesale assault on the truth. And I think that if the truth, if something that fundamental can be denied and rejected, or people can even be forced or bullied or pressured to reject it or act like they don't know the truth, then that doesn't bode well for the future, right? If people were out there saying that 1 + 1 = 3, and they're bullying and forcing and pushing people to also believe that 1 + 1 = 3, and they're going and they're changing school curriculums and they're doing this and this to make it that 1 + 1 = 3, then everyone should be concerned by that, not necessarily because they are mathematicians or because they love mathematics, but because it's an assault on the truth. And if that is given up, then what else can people be made to accept?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. And it goes to the title of Rod Dreher's book, Live Not by Lies, of course, is drawing that from Alexander Solzhenitsyn. I think what the trans movement is trying to do is force us to live by lies. I noticed even the other day, somebody sent me a link to the Pennsylvania government website, which, you know, blithely asserts that gender is not binary. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking this website rests upon a whole highly contentious gender theory that is challenged at every single level by intelligent people. Mm-hmm. And yet now it's simply being asserted as if it was a brute fact. So I think what we're seeing is an attempt to make society conform to a lie. And that's a deep problem. And I am concerned that certainly I think it's too close to it to make an accurate call at the moment. But I think we're seeing a rise of this stuff among young people because we're training them to be confused.
Yes.
And I think on the back of COVID, where a lot of young people sat at home and did social media all day long, that confusion has been exacerbated. So I do think that, I agree with you. It's a small percentage of what I would describe as genuine sufferers from this. But I think at least in the short to medium term, it could be a bigger social problem because this kind of gender confusion is becoming cool and trendy. It's being promoted as such on TikTok, etc. And it has the full weight of the medical and political establishment behind it, which makes it very dangerous at this point.
Yes. And it's not just ideas. I mean, you are talking about making permanent and irreversible changes to people's bodies, both adults, but especially concerning that this is crossing the boundary into children. And I think that is that's a huge glaring alarm, or it certainly should be to people.
I mean, blocking puberty for gender confused kids, it's insane. I mean, puberty is actually the way of sorting out the confusion. 93% of kids 88 to 93% of kids who are confused about their gender identity, if they go through puberty, will have that confusion solved. That tells me, following the science, that naturally produced hormones are the way that the body solves the problem. Mm-hmm. The idea that we stop the process that solves a problem in order to allow the kid to make up their own mind, that's insane. What we're essentially doing is saying, let's really make the kid confused, mm-hmm. and stop, and then engage, as you pointed to, some fairly horrific medical treatments that can lead to
sterilization.
Kids will never be able to have children. No. And we're telling them they can make that decision at 12. We don't allow 12-year-old kids to decide to have tattoos. Mm-hmm. And we're saying they can make that decision age 12. Yeah. That's crazy.
And it's you're the bad person for saying that that is crazy when it is very clearly crazy.
I'm the hate monger. What's interesting, of course, is that Europe, of all places, is beginning to move away from this radicalism. Mm-hmm. Just at the very moment when the United States seems to be digging itself in even deeper into this ideological framework, we see Britain, for example, closing down the Tavistock Clinic, which was the flagship gender reassignment treatment center in England. We're beginning to see in Europe signs that, people are realizing that this, however well meant it may be, is actually having very, very evil and damaging consequences for young people.
Yeah, it really is. It's, it's odd. I think that, and I have so many thoughts on this. Number one is, with a lot of these issues, it goes outside this as well, but I often just wonder, are we just too comfortable, right? Western, developed society, developed countries, things have been peaceful, relatively peaceful for several decades. At this point, millions of men are not being shipped off to die in war. We're not actually dealing with true pestilence and pandemics in the way that we have in the past, where things have swept through the population with a 10, 20, 30, 50% mortality rate. I mean, life is just so comfortable. And it seems interesting to me that just as a casual observer, that it seems that when human beings, both on an individual level and on a societal and perhaps national level, when we don't have enough real problems or hardships, we go and create them. That really seems to be what's going on, where so many of the issues now are problems of overabundance, problems of comfort. I mean, it's fascinating because in my own life, I mean, to be healthy now in modern society, if you live in the USA, to be healthy, you actually have to go out of your way to create hardships and burdens that you don't naturally have to deal with. Going to the gym is a simple example of this, right? Yeah. Every time I go to the gym, I'm thinking this is kind of funny because, I mean, I think if my ancestors were to watch this, they'd be really confused, right? If our ancestors were to see people, especially when people drive to the gym. So wait, you get in a vehicle, you drive, and then you get on a treadmill and you start lifting weights and you do this for an hour or two, and then you go back and they'd be like, why don't you just go work on a farm, go do some manual labor, go build something? And it's odd because you have to go out of your way to artificially sort of create this false hardship just to keep your body and to keep your mind healthy. If you just kind of go with the flow and just live the, I mean, I could just sit in this room on this chair and I can make my living. I can be fed. I can order in food. I can get everything I need. I can buy things. I don't even need to go out to the store. I can have things delivered to me. I can just sit here in this chair for the next several years and I can make my money. I can eat food. I can take care of my basic needs. It's not good for my mental health. It's not good for my physical health. It's not good for my spiritual health, but it's possible. And it's only in this part of the world where that's possible, and it's only at this moment in time, and we've never been here before. Even in terms of communication, I can have conversations with people, I can connect with all these people. I don't need to go outside.
Yeah, I think you're correct, and you're also, I think, pointing towards another dimension of this issue, and that's technology. Because what we're witnessing is also the creation of issues that that depend upon technology. Again, go back to my analogy, the example of the two doctors 100 years ago and today. One of the reasons why the doctor 100 years ago would have had to have given that answer, it's a problem of the mind, not the body, is he couldn't have imagined a world where the body could be gerrymandered to make it look like that of the opposite sex. And that runs very deep. My wife and I were in Carlisle, Pennsylvania recently, and happened to walk through along the street one evening. There was a pro-abortion rally going on, and one of the signs there was said something like, consent to sex is not consent to pregnancy. And I commented to my wife, it's an interesting statement that's only possible in a highly technologized society, because in times past, consent to sex was at least consent to the possibility of pregnancy. It's only when we have very easy access to contraception, then we've got abortion as a safety net, that we can think consent to sex is in no way consent to pregnancy. And what you've just described as the world in which you and I now live is very much a technological world, that our possibilities are determined by the technology we have. And of course, I remember seeing an Amish individual interviewed in a paper some years ago, making sort of the exact point you were making and expressing bemusement at the fact that we create all these labor-saving devices in order to carve out time for us to get to the gym and do all the things that, you know, harden our bodies that would naturally have been done if we were working in the fields and scattering the seed and that sort of thing.
So. Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, I guess every generation has to deal with its own challenges. And I think for sure, technology, smartphones, social media, and, you know, as you alluded to, bigger technologies, birth control pill. I mean, that's an atom bomb in terms of, that's a bigger technology than the atom bomb in the way I think it's changed society and culture. And we have these constant ongoing battles where we're in a place where, in many ways, we've just never been in this place before. We've never had a society at this level, at this stage. It's not like this around the entire world. Oftentimes people say, oh, you know, the world is going mad. The world is crazy. Yeah. And I'm like, it's kind of the West, especially the Anglosphere. It's not really the entire world that's going along with all this. You can go to South America, any country in Africa, most countries in Asia, the Middle East, they're not dealing with the same thing and having these same conversations. So it's so interesting to me sort of where trying to work out where this balance is between a lot of things, the balance between conservatism and liberalism or progressivism, the balance between having technology, but also not losing our humanity and the ability to, you know, the balance between having access to all of these things, but also being able to exhibit restraint and discipline, the balance between liberty and freedom and safety and security, all of these things. And I think that we're living in an overcorrection. I use that term a lot. I think we've overcorrected on many, many issues. And I think that's what's causing a lot of the problems and a lot of division. I think people can look at the past and say, ooh, okay, you know, we touched a little bit on racism in the past. I think anyone would recognize in the USA or even in the UK, like, oh, wow, that was real nasty, explicit, you know, hardline in-law racism. That was a huge problem. People were horribly discriminated against. So, and then I often say that I think in the sort of late 90s to maybe late 2000s, we sort of struck a good balance on many of these things. And now for the past 10 years, it's been overcorrecting. So now it's like, oh, okay, people are kind of going back to some of these race essentialist ideas. They've just inverted it and they've put, you know, now white people are bad and it's okay to discriminate against, you know, this group of people because they have the privilege and the power and it's okay to do this. And actually it's bad to be colorblind and we should be seeing each other. And I'm just like, wait, what's going on, right? When it comes to the issue of you know, sexism, right? It could be like, okay, look, in the past, okay, that was a problem and that's not good. And now we're in this weird place where it's like, okay, now men are the oppressors and there's the patriarchy. And we're supposed to simultaneously believe that men and women are the same, but also very different, but also social constructs. Yeah. And one can be the other. And it's all very deranging and confusing.
Yeah, and I think you raised the issue there of social construction. I think that's a critical point in that we're all aware that there are, you know, there is a significant degree of social construction. We talked earlier about the difference between Britain and America. It's not that wherever you go on the face of the globe, hey, there are human beings and they all think and act in exactly the same way because they're human. But I think in this overcorrection that you're talking about, we've moved to the realm where social construction has come to overwhelm everything. Mm-hmm. That our understanding of a common humanity has been dissolved by all these particularities, these socially constructed particularities, such that a white guy cannot comment on the experience of a black guy because we are so different. Our experience of the world is so different that there's nothing that really binds us together in order to have, you know, common ground for common dialogue and common expression. Of course, it's self-evidently untrue. You and I are able to talk and understand each other. But the mind, the imagination is gripped by this vision of particularity that I think is undermining our ability to produce a coherent notion of society at the moment, that the things, if you like, that distinguish us are currently so much more potent and powerful than the things which bind us together.
Yeah. And it's interesting because it's just a rehash of the problem that existed in the past, right? That was the problem. The problem in the past when it comes to the issue of race was, hey, people are being judged and treated differently and separated and segregated and looked at this way or that way based on this immutable characteristic, rather than looking at people's individuality and behavior and whatever, right? There's too much focus on this. And it's strange. That balance was generally struck. And I still think it generally is out there in the real world, but there's this creeping notion of in the name of so-called progress, going back to those old ideas of, no, actually your skin color and your ancestry and these immutable characteristics are extremely important, right? When people use this term representation, right? That I can't be represented by someone who doesn't look like me, right? It's supposed to be the notion that, I don't know, apparently, according to people who believe this, I don't know, someone like David Lammy or what's that woman's name? What's that woman's name? In the Labour Party, who's a little bit Diane Abbott.
Oh, Diane.
Right. I mean, I do not share their politics and worldview at all. Right. But apparently they represent me more than someone who might look different, but actually have a much more similar worldview. And I mean, to me, that concept in itself is, I'm like, that's kind of racist, right? And this is happening on all these different things, and it's very odd, and it's causing people to say and do things that are honestly genuinely offensive in some cases, and they're trying so hard to overcorrect on what they perceive to be some type of injustice or issue that they end up doing the same thing. They're just kind of doing it in a different direction.
Yeah. And it comes down, I think, as well to the very simplistic categories that people use.
Yes.
I've engaged a couple of times over the last year with on critical race theory stuff. And I've tried to make the point that, hey, I'm an immigrant in the United States. Does that mean that I can only be represented by somebody who grew up in Gloucestershire and has had my experiences? Does my immigrant status not count for anything? Hey, I don't even have a vote. You know, I'm a green card holder. I think what we see emerging is, you know, certain categories, I hate to use the word, but certain categories just get privileged and become dominant and grip the imagination. Whereas in actual fact, maybe this is one thing that intersectionality could do well, but generally doesn't do well. You know, intersectionality points the fact that life is complicated.
Yes.
In fact, what intersectionality does is it just reduces everything to power plays, which is, I think, again, a simplistic move. But at least intersectionality points out the fact that the categories we use need to be more complicated than the ones that are typically traded in. Where intersectionality fails, of course, is it doesn't understand what it means to be a human. And I think that's where the big issue is. We need to recapture a common sense of humanity. Because as soon as you do that, somebody's going to say to you, yeah, but that's just a sneaky way of making white heterosexual maleness normative for human nature. And I understand, and I don't want to say, I'll tell you what's a possibility. Sorry.
They've gotten so silly that they would, with a serious face, say the same thing to me. Right. So if I said that, they'll say, oh, well, you know, you're upholding, right? Now they've even saying, you know, I've seen articles on multi-ethnic or multiracial whiteness. Yeah. Right. And they now have this idea where we know whiteness is not even connected to being white. So even if you're a so-called person of color, I don't like that term, then you can still be upholding whiteness or white supremacy by wanting to see people as individuals. Yeah. And the point on intersectionality is interesting as well, because taking to its logical conclusion, you just end up with what we'd already worked out. Everyone is an individual.
Yeah.
Everyone is different. There are thousands of different factors that make each person individual and uniquely different and have a different way that they experience the world and so on and so forth, right? For whatever reason, they picked, you know, race, sex, and sexuality as the big three, right? So that's why they say, you know, straight, white, male, black, lesbian, woman, and so on, as if all straight white males, whether they're a Polish immigrant, or they're from an aristocracy in France, or they're a working class guy in Glasgow, all these people apparently who don't even speak the same language, apparently, you know, they all just have the same experience. They're all somehow oppressors of, you know, and I think people also forget that so-called people of color make up, like, I don't know what, probably at least 80% of the world's population, right? Yeah. Like on a global level, like white people are very much a minority. And even this term, I mean, white, it's very, very strange. What's the word I'm looking for? It's just such a low resolution view of the world that it amazes me that people in academia and, you know, some high, you know, some intellectual smart people get so caught up in this stuff, when I'm just like, man, like, it's really not, human beings are so much more complex than that.
Yeah. And I think what you're commenting on there is that there's a difference between, say, using race as one lens where one could look at a broader reality and say, well, yeah, as you've already said, race plays a factor. You know, for me to say to you, the color of your skin has no relevance to the way you've experienced the world, Zuby, that'd be self-evident nonsense. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, to say that it is the primary determining factor, that's a different claim. And I think what we see in the sort of the rise of things like critical race theory is not, it's not a movement that says, hey, race is a factor and we need to take this seriously. And as you've said earlier, you know, we can point to laws that were, you know, segregation was racist, clearly racist. It's not doing that. What it's doing is it's claiming something much deeper, and that is a comprehensive view of reality. It's less a tool in a toolbox than it is the whole toolbox, we might say. I was very grateful. I trained when I did my undergraduate work at Cambridge. I was a classics major, and I focused, one of my major focuses was ancient history, and I was very privileged to have a Marxist supervisor. And what interested me about him was I learned things from him that I consider to be good tools in trying to decode the past. Yeah, money's important. If you look at which way the money's flowing, it will give you important insights as to what's going on. Where I would break with him, though, is saying that's the only thing worth looking at. No. Yes. Class, money, these are important. They give us a facet of the truth, but we cannot reduce the truth to these things. And again, intersectionality sort of tries to play that card, but as you pointed out, it still operates along what we might call the politically correct and acceptable tram lines. Only certain categories are allowed to play with privilege in the intersectional debate.
Yeah, and they miss out some really obvious ones and some that are far more, you know, far more impactful, right? I mean, if you wanted to talk about the concept of privilege, right? I mean, people are there talking about skin color. I mean, what about socioeconomic status? Yeah. What about having both parents? What about having parents who love you? What about IQ? What about physical attractiveness?
Yeah.
What about Hi, what about being born in this time rather than being born 500 years ago? What about being born in a country like the UK or USA versus being born in a poor part of Ethiopia or Rwanda, right? There are so many factors. And I mean, I guess I understand. I guess as human beings, we're always trying to simplify the complex world around us. And I think that some of these ideas and ideologies are very attractive to people because they take something very complex and they simplify it. So if you can just look at the world and go, okay, you know what? Rather than dealing with all this complexity, let's just assume that everything runs on a power dynamic.
Yeah.
Right. And everyone is playing this power game and they can play it along the lines of, you know, money, which is where you kind of have the sort of traditional Marxism, right? So you just have the bourgeoisie and the proletariat, or okay, it's race, right? You have white people oppress the people of color, and every interaction, every dynamic, every law, every rule, everything is based around that. Or you can have the gendered lens, right? You know, males, there's this, you know, thing called the patriarchy, which every man in the world, even boys, little boys, are somehow a part of, and everything is set up to oppress and deny opportunities to women. And these things are attractive because they're simple and they can explain everything. They can explain everything incorrectly, but they can also, but they can't explain, they can explain everything. It's the problem is just that it's incorrect. It's a gross oversimplification. And also I think the biggest issue with it beyond its inaccuracy is that it's just a very uncharitable view of humanity, right? There are many things and aspects we can criticize in culture, society, individuals, and, you know, groups of individuals, but it's such an uncharitable view. And it also is clearly, it's just clearly false. I mean, whenever you say a statement like when people say something like all white people are racist, I'm just like, do you exist in the real world?
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you just from your experiences of life, you know that that is not true.
Yeah.
Right. You don't need a study. You don't need to go deep into act. You just know that that is not correct. And the same people espousing this view, that it's weird. Like they know it's not right. So they have to do this mental gymnastics to get around it. Right. This notion, oh, every ex, all cops are bad.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think
it's not. Have you interacted with police? Like, is every single one of them?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
You know, simplistic views of the world are always very attractive. Views of the world that allow us to feel superior to others are very attractive. That's why racism's attractive. I think it's also why anti-racism is attractive. I also think that you're pointing there that this kind of stuff also breeds a certain ingratitude. I mean, part of this thing is, as you're speaking, you know, it's interesting that privilege is now a bad word. Now, there are cases of saying, yeah, certain privilege can be bad, but I consider it a privilege that my mum and dad stayed together, that I grew up in a stable home. It's not a zero-sum game, by the way. My mum and dad did not stay together at the expense of some other couple getting divorced. Mm-hmm. They actually made their marriage work through the good times and the bad times. They stuck it out. They made it work. They loved each other. And it was a privilege for me to grow up in that environment. I don't feel guilty about that privilege. I feel grateful. I feel very grateful for it. It doesn't make me feel particularly righteous because, frankly, it wasn't me that achieved it. It was my parents that achieved it. But I feel grateful. And I think when we get into this, particularly as Christians, when we start to get into deeply into aspects of critical theory, we need to be very careful that there are two things. There are a number of things, but at least two things that should be the hallmark of any Christian philosophy of the world, if you want, for want of a better term. One of them is forgiveness, because that lies at the heart of the Christian message. And the other one is gratitude, because Christianity is a religion of grace. If you're buying into a philosophy that has no place for forgiveness and no place for gratitude, it's not a Christian philosophy. It really is as simple as that.
Absolutely. And it keeps people angry. It keeps people feeling angry, resentful. I mean, oftentimes when I look at certain ideas and worldviews and belief systems, I mean, I think an interesting actual heuristic is, are the people who believe this, espouse it, and apply it, are they happy and successful?
Yeah.
Right? Are the people who are doing and saying, and with some of these ideas, I mean, you look at it, you look at what, you know, what people call, you know, the woke, and I'm like, these are just angry resentful. I mean, these are not happy. These are not people who I'm like, oh, cool. I want that type of life. I mean, they're angry, and they have to be angry all the time. Like that's part of it. You have to be angry. You have to have resentment for at least some people in society. Otherwise, you know, it takes the wind out of the sails. And I'm just like, man, I mean, what if those people took that same energy and you applied it to yourself and improving yourself and sorting out your own family and doing positive work within your own community, instead of just going out and trying to scream at everyone else and try to tear everything down and dismantle and deconstruct everything. Yeah. It's like, hey, go work on yourself, man. And they don't want to do that.
And this is where I think that, you know, there's a lot talked about critical theory being cultural Marxism. And there's a certain case to be made for that. But I think that another person whose analysis of ethics and morality allows us to explain critical theory is Friedrich Nietzsche and his concept of ressentiment, where he sees a lot in this world as motivated by negation. The desire to destroy, the desire to overcome, the desire to invert things. And for him, it's not a good thing. You know, ressentiment speaks of it. It's impossible to translate it to English, but it means something like festering, boiling resentment, whereby you constantly define yourself in negative terms over against that which you think is powerful and dominant. That's the critical theorists. I think they are, or at least the critical race theorists, they're angry. The critical gender theorists, they're angry, and they define themselves purely in terms of negation. If you ask them what the positive vision is, they find it very hard to articulate. They have this belief that, well, if we can just tear everything down, of course, utopia will somehow emerge from the ruins. That's not going to happen.
No, it's also very arrogant.
Oh, unbelievable.
It's unbelievably arrogant to think. I mean, to me, it's like opening up, I'm not a mechanic, right? But it's like opening up the, you know, opening up an engine and just, you know, taking a hammer and tools and just sort of smashing stuff around. Or, I'm not a surgeon, right? But I open up a human body and I just start moving stuff around and, we don't need that. Get rid of that. I don't know what that does. Let's get rid of it. Just moving stuff around and thinking that I'm somehow going to make that body or engine function better than it does. So whilst on an emotional level, I can understand sometimes why people have this reaction of, oh, you know, the whole thing, the whole system, we just need to rip it apart and so on. But there's this arrogance, as again, especially considering what I said before about many of these people, it's honestly, I'd say all of these people, they typically don't have their own house in order. So it's like, you can't sort out your own life and get your own house in order, but you have this hubris to believe that you can completely alter society and a whole nation, and it's going to come out better, not worse. Be careful with that.
You can talk about smashing capitalism, and capitalism may well have its problems, but you don't want to smash it until you've got something to replace it with, because an awful lot of people are going to starve. If you just tear the whole system down, we better all be market gardeners, because we're going to have to find our food somewhere.
Yeah. And it's also funny because it's been tried before.
Oh,
it's been tried. But that's the thing is just, okay, past 100 years, we have multiple instances in different countries, different parts of the world with different cultures. You know, okay, what happens if you just throw out capitalism and you institute, you know, communism at the state level? What happens? Oh, okay, we tried. Okay, we tried it once. Let's try it again. Okay, horrible results again. Let's try it again. And so I'm like, this is no longer experimental. Even it's like, oh, look, we know where this goes. We can accept that. Yes, you know, I'm a free market capitalist, but I can understand that there can be perverse incentives with certain things when everything is driven by a profit motive, and there are some checks and balances that perhaps might be needed to stop. I don't know. We probably wouldn't want Apple and Google and Facebook and Amazon. We probably wouldn't want those all merging into one super global corporate, right? Like that. We probably don't want that to happen, right? Yeah. When you have capitalism on a global scale and everything gets exported, everything's now being manufactured in China and whatever, that can have some issues, right? Like you can accept and be aware of some of the potential issues and be considerate of how those should potentially be addressed without just saying, okay, well, because that exists, we need to just tear down the entire thing. Yeah. And it also just denies the reality of another problem with some of these ideas is they just deny human nature.
Yeah. Yeah, they tend to be abstractions. They're dealing with the abstract rather than actually dealing with how people really operate and live. And I was actually writing something this morning, a short article for World Magazine, and it's a lesser known piece of George Orwell, but was hugely influential on me as a young man. And that's the second half of his book, The Road to Wigan Pier. First half is really Orwell's travelogue of traveling through the north of England during the Great Depression and witnessing real poverty. Mm. The second half of the book, though, is this long polemical critique of middle-class Marxists in the 1930s, which I think translates easily into present day, one might say, of middle-class critical theorists. Mm. What Orwell is essentially saying there is the problem with Marxism is it's too theoretical. It deals with abstractions. It doesn't deal with real people living in real circumstances. And what happens when the left gets totally wrapped up with theory is real human beings, real poor human beings, are the first ones to suffer, and they suffer the most. And I think that ties in nicely with what you're saying, that we have to deal with the system as it really is. We have to reform the system in a way that takes account of the fact these are real human beings who have real ways of life and need to be respected and cared for as individuals and as real human beings, not just as statistics or categories or races or classes. We need to think in far more concrete terms. And I'm very sympathetic to what I would see as Orwell's anti-theoretical bias in his politics.
Absolutely. So, Dr. Truman, where do we go from here?
Well, Rod Dreher would say Hungary. You know, let's all fly to Hungary. I think that the answer, there are a couple of things to bear in mind. One, each of us needs to ask, where can we make most impact? We all have different callings. You're a huge public figure. You have a platform that allows you to speak. And my former research assistants were amazed when they heard I was going to be on. I thought, wow. Gosh, this guy must be huge. I'm of an age where I'm just disconnected from pretty much everything. But you have a huge platform. So for a guy like you, there's tremendous opportunity to have a wonderful impact upon the rising generation, getting them to think about these key issues. For many others, we don't have the same big platform, but we can make an impact in our local communities. We can make an impact in our churches, in our neighborhoods, in our synagogues. We can make an impact in our workplace. And I think I would like to see people in the next decade turning away from the abstractions of social media, if you like, where people are just pixels on a screen, and reconnecting with real communities, real human beings, making a difference where I think God has placed us to make a difference. So for me, the first thing we've got to do is recapture a local vision, if you like, or most of us have to recapture a local vision. There are national figures, but most of us are not national figures. We might like to think we are because of our Twitter accounts, but in actual fact, we're local figures, and we can make an impact in our local communities. And that's where I'd like to see. And my wife and I, I love writing, I love traveling and speaking, but the thing I love most is being in the classroom at Grove City College and then opening my house for hospitality to students, because that's where I engage with real people and that's where I can make a real impact.
I love that. I think we need to use technology to enhance and deepen our human connections rather than replace them.
Yeah.
Or push us further and further away from each other.
Use technology to respect the real.
Yes.
And enhance the real rather than to replace and supplant the real.
Yeah, I love that. Carl, where can people find you online?
I don't do social media, and publish anything that doesn't go through an editor. So but I don't trust myself, essentially. So the places to find me would be firstthings.com. I write every 2 weeks. I write a column for the First Things website. It's a website devoted really to sort of religious conservatism, not exclusively Christian, but primarily Christian. And I also do an op-ed column for world opinions online every 2 weeks as well. So First Things and World would be the places to find me.
Awesome. And where can people get your book?
You can buy it. You can buy it from The Beast. You can buy it from Amazon. You can buy it direct from Crossway. You could probably find it at Eighth Day Books, which is the best bookstore in the United States, down in Kansas. So Eighth Day Books would be a place to get it, but you'll find it in Amazon, at Crossway.
Awesome. Dr. Carl Truman, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me. It's been a real, real pleasure.
This country was built on a distinctly American work ethic, but today, work is in trouble. We've outsourced most of our manufacturing to other countries, and with that, we sent away good jobs and diminished our capability to make things. American Giant is a clothing company that's pushing back against this tide. They make a variety of high-quality clothing and activewear, like sweatshirts, jeans, dresses, jackets, and so much more. All made right here in the USA, from growing the cotton and adding the final touches. So when you buy American Giant, you create jobs for seamsters, cutters, and factory workers in towns and cities across the United States. And it's about more than an income. Jobs bring pride, purpose. They stitch people together. If all that sounds good to you, visit American-Giant.com and get 20% off your first order when you use code STAPLE20 at checkout. That's 20% off your first order at American-Giant.com with promo code STAPLE20.